What's next? Hills Have Eyes?
That's right. This is the movie retrospective this week.
That's a classic, man. It's a
classic. It is. You know what's really weird, and I think I mentioned this on one of our sidetrack shows, is that I had already planned to do Hills Have Eyes for this week because it was on Shudder, and I was like, oh, that's a classic, and we haven't got around to it.
And lo and behold,
listener, friend of the show, Dominic, sent me the deluxe Blu-ray from Arrow Video of The Hills Have Eyes before we'd even finished watching it on Shudder, because I watched a part of it and then I was like really sleepy.
She fell
asleep because it was like fucking midnight and I was
drunk. Went over to the Blu-ray, watched all the extras and everything, and it was a good movie, man. It was a good movie.
It really is.
I saw it, I think, man, when was the first time I saw this shit? I think I saw it on VHS. That must have been, I think I was in Brazil.
Yeah.
When I was in high school. Probably around 86. Probably around that. 85, 86.
Because it came out in 1977.
Yeah, it was old when I saw it.
Yeah.
And I was impressed with it when I saw it. It kind of... There's some weird... The weird thing about this movie is it's kind of like Chainsaw Massacre, where it's not real graphic, but because of the way it sounds and the way it's shot and the score... It seems a lot more graphic and a lot scarier than it really should be based on what you're seeing.
Yeah, you know I definitely, and you can tell too. I mean, this is only Wes Craven's, I believe it's only his third movie. His first one obviously was Last House on the Left. And then I think he made like another one in between there that maybe, I can't remember if it was even a horror movie or not. But then he ended up doing this one, and he definitely said that, I mean, Texas Chainsaw Massacre was one of Wes Craven's favorite movies.
Okay, you can see it in this.
And he definitely wanted to make something that was a little bit of an homage to that.
Okay, I got you.
So it definitely does have that 70s grindhouse, like just that grotty, sleazy kind of feel to it, because it looks like kind of cheap, and it looks almost like a snuff film.
Yeah, or crime scene photos. but there's a lot of shit hidden into it. I mean, the acting actually is kind of good.
Yeah.
It's good. You know what I mean? Even, all right, we got to set it up. This movie is basically almost kind of like a Mad Max Road Warrior, a Mad Max kind of post-apocalyptic type story about some city people. It's, you know, just regular family out in the middle of nowhere, run into some damn fucking like post-apocalyptic cavemen. Or cannibals, but they talk.
Yeah,
they're wild men, feral family.
Yeah,
you know, of people, and they're robbing travelers and eating them, and they're raping them and eating them too, and they're just like from another fucking planet. You know what I mean? They don't know much about the outside world. I guess they're kind of isolated. I guess they kind of have their own little worries, but kind of hidden in this story. You know, all their names are the names like Greek gods, like Jupiter and Mercury, you know,
and Mars.
And there is kind of like almost kind of like a Greco-Roman kind of story going between like the Titans, you know, the evil gods and shit like that. It's kind of what you...
Yeah, that's an interesting way of looking at it.
Because Kronos was eating his son, and there's all that kind of shit.
Yeah, because Wes Craven did bring that up.
Yeah.
That Goya painting, very famous.
Right. The old gods that the Romans and the Greeks believed in, the old Titans, you know, they got retired because they were too evil.
Yeah.
Even though they're not named after Titans, but they're kind of, still kind of like the Titans. They're named after, you know, Roman gods, Jupiter and shit. Jupiter's dad was a fucking
Titan.
Yeah. And, you know, the Titans would eat each other, you know, and shit like that. So that's kind of what, to me, it was kind of like they were talking about the Titans.
Yeah. Well, the thing about Wes Craven is that even though, I mean, he kind of gets to, he's a horror director, and a lot of his early films, like Last House on the Left, which we reviewed a while back, and this one, it's like he kind of got, you know, that he makes like these exploitation or like super violent movies, which he does. But you have to think that Wes Craven, he started out as a professor. And a lot of his movies, you know, as quote unquote sleazy or violent as they may be, actually do have some sort of deeper themes or deeper ideas behind them. It's like he apparently got the idea for this. Like I said, and we watched, there's a really good interview with him that's on the Blu-ray where he's talking about kind of his inspirations for this. Like I said, he really liked Texas Chainsaw Massacre. He also liked The Grapes of Wrath, you know, the novel, and wanted to do something along those lines. But he was also talking a little bit about Greek mythology and about how those stories like still hang around, as because the themes like still resonate. So he wanted to do something about that. How he got the specific idea for this was he was he went to the New York Public Library, evidently, and he was looking through like just all their fucked up shit section, I guess, like where all the horrible crime and stuff was. And he started reading about, and I think we did a show about, I don't think we did a whole entire show about this topic, but we did one that was like stories that movies were based on. The Scottish cannibal clan of Sawney Bean or Shawnee Bean, which was a very similar thing.
Similar idea.
It was like an incestuous family that lived in a cave, like
underneath
in Scotland somewhere. Yeah, like the water would come up and nobody knew where they went.
The tide
like,
would come in. And
16th century, 17th century, I can't quite remember. And they were supposedly, that was their thing. Like every time there was travelers like on the road or whatever, they would just come out and like kill and eat them. And that's how they survived.
Yeah.
And he got fascinated by the fact that once the family got caught, he found it very, like, sort of morbidly amusing that when they got caught, they're like, the authorities did pretty much the same shit to them, like, to punish them as they were doing to other, you know, they put them on the rack and, like, burned them alive and shit like that. So he just found it very interesting.
That the civilized people were uncivilized.
Were doing the same shit that they were punishing the uncivilized people for doing.
That was his opinion, though.
Yeah.
If you ask me, a lot of these motherfuckers that we're talking about, the shit that they do to little kids and little fucking animals and, you know, little kittens and shit. No, I'd fuck you up, too.
That's what I mean.
What the authorities did to that particular family, it made sense in the context of the time because they went, well, these motherfuckers are savage. We're going to do some Old Testament shit. That's what they did to them.
And I can see how, you know, the thing about The Hills Have Eyes, whether or not he was intentionally trying to make a statement about, you know, these quote unquote civilized people that break down in the desert and then become like a victim to this family who, for their part, yes, they were trying to survive. Yes, they had been cast out by their dad, Fred, who was the guy that owned the, you know, the gas station or whatever, because they were, but they were cast out because they were feral, because Jupiter was horrible.
He was born like a monster, he said.
Right. And so, like, he just, like, cast him out, and then, like, he went and formed a family.
And then what's weird is that they called him Papa Jupiter. His dad hit him in the head with an axe and thought he killed him and left him out in the desert, but he survived.
Yeah, so he has, like, this big, like...
Yeah, the makeup's kind of cheesy, but, you know, you get the idea. And they called him Papa Jupiter, and he had all these kids, and he is kind of like a Roman god or a Greek god or a Titan to him, you know. There's all these dynamics where he's real tyrannical to him, giving him orders, and they're trying to live up to him, and, you know, and then the brothers are in competition for, you know, brownie points to Papa, you know. And then there's another family theme that was kind of cool, is that they got this girl, Papa Jupiter's daughter.
Ruby.
His name Ruby. And I guess she's like the jewel of the family. There was no Greek goddess named Ruby. but she was trying to get out of it.
Yeah, because she was like the only one with a conscience.
Yeah, she was kind of like a pretty cave girl with bad teeth. That was the running around real fast, real athletic. I liked her little costume and shit. You know, you could tell they're trying to play up the fact that, you know, she had nice legs and shit.
Yeah, she actually got the job partially because she could run faster than any of the other actresses that tried out. Because there's so much running involved in the movie, her character.
I thought Ruby was one of the most interesting characters, especially in the beginning, you know, when she's trying to trade with her granddad, and she's trying to looking around, eyes darting around, you know, like, don't you make noise when you walk? She goes, no. It's just kind of funny, you know?
She is like a funny, and you know what's funny? It's I didn't even realize this until we were watching the movie, and then, like, there was an interview with her. There was an interview with, like, pretty much all the actors. Michael Berryman was on there, who always seemed like a delightful human being. But there was an interview with her, and I was like, God damn it. I was like, she's so familiar, and she must have been in some other movies. So we looked up her IMDb page. That was the same goddamn woman that was in The Incredible Melting Man, that was in the redneck chick that was coming back from the movies, and then the Melting Man, like, attacked the trailer and everything. And I was like, holy shit, I never... My mind was blown.
She's a B-movie scream queen. She's been in a bunch
of shit. But that's where I recognize her from. Because Incredible Melting Man was on MST, so I've seen that movie probably like 100 times.
So she's probably, you know, making a living on the damn circuit, you know, signing autographs. That's probably
the horror
conventions. That's where a lot of these people make their money. But I did like the fact that, I did like her story arc of that character, especially in the alternate ending of the movie, which is a different edit, and it has a couple seconds of a new scene that kind of shows that Ruby was redeemed, that she did, she was able to get out of there. And I liked that fact that Craven threw that in there, because he's showing an evil, monstrous family. All right, and there in life there are many evil and monstrous families, and just because maybe you're born into something like that doesn't mean that you're without hope.
Yeah, that you can't get out of it.
She got out of there.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of people that have escaped fucking monstrous fucking families. Not this monstrous, but pretty fucking monstrous. So I like the fact that he put that in there.
Yeah.
That just because your family's fucked up, that doesn't really have anything to do with you.
Yeah, you can
get out of that shit.
Yeah.
It makes it
harder, obviously, right. But, you know, yeah, so it's interesting that, because if you've seen, like, I guess the theatrical cut, it ends actually kind of abruptly,
right,
with, you know, the one character, like, from the Nice family from Ohio.
Let me give a lowdown on the Nice family first, though. Nice family is, an older man and woman. It's my stepdad and some chick.
Big Bob,
Bob is, that's the way my stepdad was. He's a fucking dick.
He was a douche, yeah.
So you see that dude, go, that's my fucking stepdad. So you got my stepdad.
It was exactly like your stepdad.
And then his sons are like, one of them, Sonny Bono, and his hot girlfriend. And
that's his wife.
Yeah, Dee Wallace. Dee Wallace.
And they have a baby.
Dude, dude looks just like Sonny Bono.
He does.
And then you got the gay Luke Skywalker and his girlfriend.
And no, that's his sister.
It's his sister?
That was his sister, the little blonde.
To me, I don't know. They never mention it. It's not totally obvious, but to me, I'm just going, that's a gay dude.
It might have been. They interviewed the actor. It's hard to tell, you know.
It's hard to tell. Was he supposed to be gay, or was he just a gay actor? And it wasn't, and it was coming
and
through.
And he was just being himself. Just being himself.
I kind of think it was both.
Yeah.
But it worked.
He
had that damn 45, and he was fighting to protect his fucking family. He did a lot of fucking brave shit.
Yeah.
So I liked that character. But he was basically Luke Skywalker in many ways.
He did look very Mark Hamill.
He looked like Mark Hamill. They had that damn... That look was real popular in the 70s.
Oh, yeah.
And that was kind of like the blonde fucking young guy, you know what I mean? That was a type, an archetype back then. Just like they had the Burt Reynolds type, which...
Yeah.
They needed a Burt Reynolds in this, actually.
Well, Sonny Bono guy was a little bit. He had the mustache.
No, he was Sonny Bono. He wasn't
a totally different thing.
Yeah, totally fucking.
But I was gonna say that. I mean, so you have like the Nice family and the fucked up family, and Wes Craven was kind of like, well, I wanted them to be kind of like mirror images of each other. But the thing about it was that the Cannibal family were terrible. I mean, other than Ruby. It's like, yes, they needed to survive. Yes, you know, that one guy got thrown out, I guess, by his dad when he was a kid and stuff like that. But that doesn't really excuse, like, all the shit that they did. Because it's like, they come and, like, invade this poor family's trailer. They rape the blonde girl. And then they kill Dee Wallace. They kill the mom. And then they steal the baby. And they're going to eat the baby.
Yeah. They called it a turkey.
Yeah.
Christmas turkey. Like
yeah, Thanksgiving turkey. I don't remember what they said.
Turkey,
yeah, and it's like, well, do you know that Wes Craven...
There's a lot of comedy in this movie. As morbid as this shit is, and really the fucking evil family... And what's funny is they're on a mount, like Mount Olympus in a way. Even though
they shot it in the Mojave Desert.
But I think that the whole Greek thing about being up in a mountain might be going back to the Titans and the fucking gods and shit. You know?
It could possibly be.
I think that's part of it.
Because I do think Wes Craven was like aware of that. I mean, he did talk some about like Greek mythology and stuff when he was talking about the
movie. He's trying to make this a mythological tale, to have like a fucking mythological background in the same way that Star Wars had a mythological background. So in that way, it's a well-crafted tale.
Yeah.
It's well-executed. I mean, it's a grindhouse flick, but that's a genre now.
Yeah.
So... The movie's aged real well. It's better now than it was.
I mean, it's obviously the gore and stuff like that isn't shocking like it was in 1977.
It doesn't even need it.
But it doesn't really need that because it still has that like gritty. Like I said, that's why it's hard to replicate movies that came out in the 70s like Texas Chainsaw Massacre and stuff. Yes, you can remake them. And yes, you know, even the Texas Chainsaw Massacre remake was okay. But it's not. You can't capture that same time period. You can't capture like that snuff film, like I shouldn't be watching this.
Yeah, you're like, I'm feeling dirty looking at this.
Yeah, he's like, I need a shower now. And it's like,
it's down to the little details, the fucking kind of mediocre film quality. The edits, abrupt edits, you could tell it's kind of a crude edit between cuts.
Yeah, Wes Craven edited it as well.
Yeah, and you can tell that it's old-fashioned technology that they're working with. The little details, stuff that's up in the damn camper. You know what I mean? What kind of bag of cookies that they're eating? It was all shit we remembered as kids. You just can't.
That bag of cookies at the stretch. We were like, oh my god,
animal crackers!
I remember those with with the icing on them.
Yeah, the pink and white.
That pink, like that hard icing, like the fondant type icing.
Yeah,
on
with
it.
The little tiny fucking colored dots on them. That's what. They
didn't, man, I remember.
They only
those.
Showed the top of that package.
I forgot all about it until we saw that bag.
Fuckers were delicious.
They really were. I don't think they make them anymore.
Crumbly butter. It was
like they were so
crumbly butter with icing on it, man. Pink icing.
They were really good.
Yes, they were.
And it's just like really funny. I had forgotten all about them. But as soon as we saw that bag, I was like, oh shit, I remember those fucking cookies.
Yeah.
But yeah, so one thing too, Wes Craven actually wanted the family to eat the baby or to kill the baby.
Yeah.
And apparently all the cast rebelled. They're like, no, we don't think that's a good idea.
I think it's probably a better,
we're not doing that.
It was a better idea not to kill it because then there was something to save.
Yeah, because, I mean, the whole point of the thing and what I was getting to before was that, yes, these families could be seen as mirror images of each other, like the civilized family, the uncivilized family, and shit like that. But that said, though, I'm not sure, like, how clear that distinction is because the cannibal family are clearly bad and the good family only do what they do because they're fighting to defend their own family. I mean, Sonny Bono is trying, like the Sonny Bono guy is like, you know, fighting to get his baby back. I mean, these people killed his wife. They raped his sister-in-law and they stole his baby.
Yeah.
So yes, you were going to go get medieval on these motherfuckers.
Right.
Not because you're a bad person, but because
you had to.
You have to.
Another good thing about this movie was a birth of a fucking screen legend. Michael. What's Michael's last name?
Michael Berryman.
Michael Berryman is a very strange looking fellow, man. He looks like he's like something out of a heavy metal magazine. Remember the fucking comic book heavy metal?
Yeah.
He looked like something out of his very elongated head. He was born with some birth defects.
Yeah, he has more than 24 birth defects.
And he's been in a lot of movies. He was in, Weird Science.
Yeah.
He was in that. What else is he in? If you see the guy, you know who it is I'm talking about.
Well, that's what I mean. He's immediately recognizable.
They put this guy on the poster of The Hills Have Eyes, and that sold this fucking movie.
Well, he's an icon now, probably mostly because of this. Yes, I mean, he has like a horror career because of this movie, and he says that as well.
With this, he could get any kind of horror movies. He shows up. Everybody knows who this dude is. Evidently, he's extremely popular on the damn horror con fucking circuit. Probably doing very well for himself. And you'd look at him, and he's just fucking... What's funny is that you look at the dude and you go, that's not a good looking man, but there's something kind of cute about him too. It's weird. Kind of like in a way that damn cat, some of these cats that you see, Grumpy Cat.
Like Grumpy Cat.
Kind of like Grumpy Cat
Bub
or something.
Little
Bub and all that. It's something kind of like that. He's got a fucking kind of a cool look to him in a way. He looks like a mutant of some sort, which I guess he's got medical problems. I don't know if that makes you a mutant, but. He's just kind of a fucking... And they say he's just the nicest guy in the world.
I've heard that he's a delightful human being.
He's very intelligent. You know, he's got at least above average intelligence, from what I'm hearing, you know, through his interviews. So he's famous for looking like that.
Yeah.
And evidently, like a lot of shit behind... He's very popular. Evidently, behind the scene, you know, when he had a scene where he had to rape this good-looking blonde.
The blonde girl, yeah.
And in order to break the ice and shit, where they had the curtain, they were rehearsing the rape, but they were doing it as if it was a fucking love scene.
Well, yeah, because they said everyone was really, you know...
They were uptight about it. Well,
nobody likes to really have to, like, film a rape scene because it's kind of uncomfortable for everybody.
The whole crew busted up laughing when they pulled the curtains back and fucking...
And they're all making
Michael
out.
And this fucking hot chick are making out and doing this thick of thing. And it kind of broke the ice and it helped the fucking... Helped them film that scene, which, you know, they were uncomfortable filming that scene, you know?
Yeah.
Because, you know, they were all working together, but, you know, maybe they didn't know each other that well.
Yeah, I can see how that would be a little squicky.
So,
and the thing about Michael Berryman too, one of his birth defects is that, unfortunately for him on this shoot, is that he was born without sweat glands.
Yeah,
and they were filming in the Mojave Desert, which was about 120 degrees during the day, and it was like 12 to 14 hour days because it was only like a 3 week shoot or something. So it's like, yeah, he was. I think they had to have like some medical personnel on hand so he wouldn't like keel over dead or whatever.
So on the back of that, I'd probably say. Michael seemed to have a way with women.
He probably did. So, like I said, he seems like very charming.
Yeah.
I always thought he was.
Have a way with women.
You know?
And he's aged very well, according to what I've, you know, the latest interviews.
Yeah, I'm not sure when. I mean, because the interviews...
He looks as young as he did.
Yeah, he doesn't look that much different, honestly. No. The interviews that were on the Blu-ray, I'm not sure how old they were, because they had... Wes Craven was on there, and he passed away, obviously, several years ago. So, I'm not sure how old those interviews were. And this, Dee Wallace, too, this might have been her first movie or her first kind of major movie. And she kind of got into horror, like, on the back of this as well, because she was also in The Howling and she was in Cujo.
Yeah, I was watching it. I'm going, man, I know who that is. And she goes, that's Dee Wallace. And
yeah.
I said, I know, but where do I recognize her from? And she's like, I don't know. She's been in so many movies. And
I said Cujo.
Cujo. I was like, I don't really remember her from that. You know, and it's something else. And she goes, Howling. And I'm like, oh, yeah, of course. She played the reporter in The Howling.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And we reviewed The Howling, didn't we, not too long ago.
It didn't quite click. She was cute.
She was adorable.
She was cute, yeah.
But yeah, so I feel like this is probably her first one. And, you know, this movie, I think this movie ended up costing three times more than Last House on the Left, which was made for like $1.98, I have to say. But I think this movie... Wes Craven couldn't give an exact amount. I think it was $750,000, so it was under $1 million for sure. And it made $25 million. So it wasn't like a huge like breakout success or anything like that, but it made like a lot of money. And I feel like, you know, Wes Craven on the back of this and you know, Last House on the Left, he kind of got a reputation of being a horror director. And later on, obviously, he did like Nightmare on Elm Street and Scream and all that kind of stuff. The funny thing too is I was looking, because I was like, I know, you know, all the big movies that he's done, and we've reviewed a couple of his movies. We did Serpent in the Rainbow and People Under the Stairs. But I had forgotten that he had also directed, like, Swamp Thing, and he also did Vampire in Brooklyn. I totally forgot that Wes Craven directed that movie.
Yeah.
Interestingly, too, one of his lesser-known movies, Mind Ripper, was actually supposed to be a third Hills Have Eyes movie, but then they just changed it up. I mean, because he made that, like, they made a sequel, which I think I saw a long time ago and wasn't really all that impressed with. And then they were going to make a third one, like he wanted to make a third one, but then they didn't end up doing it. So he ended up doing Mind Ripper instead, which was the script for the third one, but then they changed it around. So it wasn't as similar.
Another thing about this movie that we got to mention is the score. This has a fantastic score.
It is very good. Yeah.
The limitations of the time. They did not have synthesizers. So this is all acoustic instruments, weird ass, and it's ugly, and it's made ugly on purpose, because fucking what's happening, especially in context of the time this movie is being written and performed, this is some fucking bizarre shit that nobody's ever seen before. So the guy who did the fucking score made sure that this was weird, eerie. It sounds a bit like synthesizers. It's not. It's weird stringed instruments, and it was very well thought out. I mean, he's playing music during times when the fucking bad guys are running. And he's looking at the thing, and he's seen that the necklaces are jingling, and it's all got bear claws and ammunition and fucking bones and
teeth
shit.
Teeth,
Teeth. So he says, I need those necklaces so I can rattle them. So that's in the song.
Yeah.
And he's
actually, the actual necklaces that the actors
rattling
are wearing.
With the fucking rhythm of them running, it's actually helped him get like the rhythm to the music in the back. So... the movie is just all around very well crafted. I mean, if this movie had been done wrong, it would have been forgotten. But it was remembered because the people that worked on it cared about it. They didn't have a lot of money, but they thought about what they were doing. and they maximize their performances, whatever job they had, they were really trying to do it to the best of their abilities. And it because of that, you can feel the soul in this movie.
Movies like these, like a lot of Wes Craven's movies, even though on the surface, if you don't really, you know, if you just give them kind of a cursory watch or you're not really into horror movies or whatever, you can be like, oh, it's just some like, you know, exploitation movie from the 70s, or it's just like a bunch of violence for the sake of it. But it's really not. And, you know, people that are into horror can tell the difference between ones that are just like a fucking knockoff that nobody gave a shit about, that they were just trying to make a buck off of, and ones that actually had an idea behind them and a lot of thought behind them and a lot of work and love put into them, because they were trying to, like, they had a particular vision they were trying to, you know, convey. Yeah. Don Peek was the name of the guy that did the score. There's an interview with him on the Blu-ray, which was one of my favorite interviews that we watched. He was like super enthusiastic about like the music and everything. Right. And they had like probably like a 10 or 15 minute interview with him. And he was
He heard it. And he's like, I don't know.
He's like, I don't know.
But he convinced him. And I'm glad that he went with that score, because that score fits it.
It really does fit. Yeah.
It stood up the test of time.
Yeah.
I mean, you can watch the movie now and you still get kind of a weird, eerie kind of feeling.
And I think... you know, the setting helps a lot, because I mean, obviously they actually did go out to this fucking middle of nowhere in the Mojave Desert and kind of camped out there and filmed this movie. They said it was like super hot in the day, obviously, and like really cold at night.
They were living in rough conditions, and it was because they cared about the movie. They tried to make the movie the best they possibly could.
Yeah.
And it was all new actors and all new kind of crew that hadn't really been around. They were all young.
Some of them had worked on Roger Corman movies, but that was about it. Yeah.
And they're just trying to make this fucking cool flick, you know what I mean, so they could be remembered by, and they did. And a lot of people ended up helping their career. A lot of people. Now the Sonny Bono guy, he had no idea that it was going to be that big, didn't he?
He had his own like interview where he was talking about.
He was like, I didn't realize this was, you know, there's always one or two guys that was like, I didn't think people would really give a shit about this, you know.
Well, it's funny because you know, like I said, and I think nowadays, because people that are into horror and like watch like old ones, and then, you know, you go and see the person that was in it like at the convention or whatever. But you have to think, like, for the actor, that was just like a job that they had when they were like, oh, it's like a long time ago. And it's like, they just like, I just needed a job and a paycheck. And it's like, then they probably didn't even think about it again.
And in the 70s, science fiction and horror was considered like a fucking loser.
It was lowbrow.
Loser fucking super lowbrow genre.
Like I said, it was like a step above porn, pretty much. Yeah,
and it was going to be something that only kids watched, and it was junk and you'd never see it again.
Yeah, which is very funny. And I'm glad that stigma has fallen away.
Right.
But it really did have that stink about it, even into the 80s, I think, like, because of all the slasher movies and
stuff. That helped it, though, I think.
But,
80s, that was like the golden era, and the golden age is what made horror.
Yeah.
It wouldn't, and I think it's because it was just the right guys, the right place, at the right time, with the right level of technology.
Yeah.
That you could make a fucking, and then an audience that hadn't seen it yet, had never seen that before, living through the golden era of it, fucking was the best.
Yeah.
I'm glad that I'm not 20 years old having to go back and look at that shit now, because I probably wouldn't like it as much as I liked it.
Because you didn't live through
the context of the time.
Because you can remember what shit was like back then.
Right.
And it does give like an added resonance. And I'm not saying that like younger people can't get into old, because I know like a lot of younger people that are in their 20s and 30s and are really into that old shit.
It was just back in the 70s and the 80s, this shit was so ahead of what was going on. It was so different.
Definitely. It was subversive in a lot of ways.
And it was miles ahead of what mainstream entertainment was doing. There was good mainstream entertainment, but most of it was garbage.
Yeah. So if you wanted like the really good shit, you had to kind of go underground stuff, alternative media type of stuff. I should mention before we wrap up that there was a remake of this. I believe it came out in 2006.
I saw it. It was all right.
The remake isn't bad, actually. It was done by Alexandre Aja, the famed new French extremity director.
It's not this movie, though. It's another movie.
Kind of like an updated, it still kind of has like the hillbilly horror type
they got a theme radiation
to it
theme.
But there's radiation, so these are actual like radiated mutants rather than just like people that got chucked out in the forest or into the caves and went feral.
And it's a modern movie. It's just
way gorier, but it's different.
It does not have this tone.
Yeah.
It's more like a reboot / sequel or something like that, or inspired by.
Yeah.
It'd be like trying to compare The Walking Dead with Night of the Living Dead. It'd be like that. They're both zombie movies, but Night of the Living Dead was not modern.
Yeah, that's why it's kind of hard for me to... That's why I think I've never done anything like, Jenny's Top 100 Horror Movies or anything like that, because it's really hard for me to say one movie is better than another one.
Because the context.
Because they're... Well, and a lot of them are so different from one another. It's like, and particularly horror, which is such a wide genre. I mean, you have so many different subgenres that are completely different from each other. It might as well be a completely different film genre, really.
The remake of The Hills Have Eyes, technically, and special effects, and just the edit and the way it flows, is better than this one. I didn't like it better, though.
I actually liked
the original better.
Same.
You know, it was more crude, grindhouse. It was the original.
Yeah.
You know, and it was like that. It's like comparing Star Trek, The Next Generation, and the original series. It's both Star Trek, but there's something about that original series.
Yeah.
It's just something about that original
series.
And I like them both.
I still love the original series.
The original series just...
I like the newer ones, too. Like, I like some of the newer shows, and I like the, you know, that stuff, but...
Some of the, you know, the movies.
But
I didn't really like... I liked only, like, the first two J.J. Abrams movies, and only kinda. They were taking Star Trek into the action genre.
I kind of feel like that's sort of happening with everything. They did that with a lot of horror remakes, and they did that. They're trying to make everything like a big action movie.
Yeah, stupid. Star Trek. I'm going on Star Trek. Fucking.
I know. Here we go.
Star Trek is a character-based movie. It's a mythology. It's about relationships between characters that you love.
Yeah.
And them working together and solving problems. It's not an action movie.
Well, and that's what I liked about... That's why whenever I feel like watching Star Trek and I just want to, like, have a drink or, you know, like a cup of coffee or something like that and sit down and watch some Star Trek, it's always going to be original series.
Yeah.
Because it's like, I don't give a shit. I don't really give a shit about the aliens or the monsters or nothing like that. I just want to watch Spock and Bones sniping at each other.
And if you like... I got to plug Vic Mignogna. Yeah. Right. If you like the original series, you got to see Star Trek Continues. It's on free. It's free. It's right there on YouTube. It is the fucking final season of the original series. Vic does a great fucking Captain Kirk. Fucking Todd Haberkorn does fucking Spock. The dude who played fucking Scotty, what was his name? Guy who played the original Scotty. His son plays the new Scotty.
Yeah.
It's just... And it's a lot of the same people that did writing and worked on the original series worked on this, too.
Yeah.
So Star Trek Continues. The Star Trek Continues plug
in the middle of a Hills Have Eyes review.
That's how
which is very weird. Yeah. But I can see how we got there, because like you said, I quite liked the Hills Have Eyes remake. I like a lot of that new French Extremity, horror. I like all the gore and stuff like that. It's good. I didn't mind the Texas Chainsaw Massacre remake, but... It's never going to be the same as that. I can enjoy them as two different
movies,
types of movies.
Yeah.
But I don't really see one as like being, you know, I'm remaking this one. Like, do you know what I mean? Because you still have both. You're never going to recapture the tone of 1974. You're never going to recapture the tone of 1977. Yeah. You just can't do it because we don't live back then now.
Yeah.
So, you know, we just remember it. It's in our memories, and people that weren't born then have no idea.
You can evoke it.
You can.
You can evoke it. Okay, VFW did evoke the 80s.
Yeah.
It did 80s Carpenter.
Yeah.
If you like 80s Carpenter, VFW, you need to see that movie. That's very much Escape from New York / Assault on Precinct 13. It is in a little bit more of a more modern context, but that's not the world they're talking about.
Yeah.
They're talking about Carpenter's early 1980s. That's what they're talking about. And late 70s. That's what they're talking about.
And like you said, I have seen some horror movies that were set in the 70s or set in the 80s that were very good at, like you said, evoking that time period. And having lived through that time period, you know, we can tell when somebody's just trying it and not doing it right.
And when it's working and when it's not working.
But you know what I mean? But so I'm just saying that it's just harder to do in the sense that I don't want to say that it's always going to be a pastiche because you didn't actually make it during that time period.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm watching VFW and scene for scene, I just get this weird feeling that I'm watching Assault on Precinct 13, the feeling that I'm watching Escape from New York and The Fog. I'm watching all those movies. But this is a new movie and I haven't seen it.
Yeah.
But it's those.
Which
it's
is
one,
neat.
It's one of those. Yeah. Perfect. The tone and everything. It felt like fucking Carpenter was doing the fucking score.
Yeah.
Felt like some of the guys in the bar somehow survived the fucking the Antarctic expedition from the thing. Like one of those guys might have been on that expedition. This is the way it felt to me.
And I don't have a problem at all with modern filmmakers wanting to evoke that time period, as long as they do it successfully.
They just have to know how to do it. Yeah.
Yeah, and I've seen a lot of ones that were like that.
Yeah, and you kind of have to not have money. If the less money you have, the more you will evoke that.
Well, and the more creative you can be that you have to be. Yeah. Sometimes limitations are good.
Yeah.
You know, like if you have all the money in the world, sometimes you get lazy because
you're not going to evoke that.
I mean, you go
back to Terminator 1. There's no money there. Boy, that was a fucking awesome movie.
Yeah.
Awesome fucking movie. But today, if that wasn't a union picture, you could make it for next to nothing. That movie made all kinds of fucking money. Built a whole franchise on the back of Terminator 1. Why? That was a good story.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of limitations that they worked around.
Yeah.
And it was based on the Terminator was a ripoff of an even worse movie called The Exterminator.
Yeah.
That's what they said. I've never seen that movie, but they said that movie was terrible.
But you can do that.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, if you're an artist, as long as you don't rip stuff off, like, directly. Yeah. I mean, because I've seen, like, lots of movies that, you know, especially ones from, like, the 50s or 60s or whatever. And you see ones and I'm like, man, that's a great idea.
Yeah.
It's too bad it was, like, 1955 and they didn't have any money,
right,
like, to do this. Because they could have really done this idea really cool. Like, if you take something like that and remake it and, like, change it up a little bit, then I don't have a problem with that at all. I was going to say when you were talking about making a shit ton of money, Hills Have Eyes actually, like I said, did make $25 million on a budget of less than $1 million. They said it probably would have made more, except it's like it went into limited release and then it was like really successful. Like it made $2 million like on its limited release. So they wider released it. And then as soon as they released it widely, like around the country,
people said, shut that
shit down. No, Smokey and the Bandit came out.
Oh, yeah, which we got to see that again.
And everybody went to see Smokey and the Bandit. So it's like it almost kind of got buried underneath Smokey and the Bandit. The other day when we were talking about
Smokey and the Bandit.
Well, we were talking about Joe Bob's Drive-In, and he was doing 24 Hours of Redneck Joy, and Smokey and the Bandit was one of the ones.
Got to get Smokey and the Bandit, and got to get Cannonball Run.
I saw those two movies so many times when I was growing up.
If y'all send us those movies, we'll do them. I grew up watching them thinking, I used to love that shit when I was a kid.
I did too.
I don't know how it stands up, though.
Yeah, we might see it now and be like...
like, what the fuck? Yeah.
Although I haven't had that happen too much. Like, every now and then I'll see something. I'll be like, God, what the fuck did I see in that movie? But most of the time, like, when I see one that I liked as a kid, I'm just like, it's still good.
I used to watch Cannonball Run as a little kid. Cannonball Run and the other one, sitting up on a fucking bed, fucking pouring fucking salted peanuts in my Coca-Cola. And Pepsi. Pepsi. Or RC.
It better be RC Cola.
Probably RC Cola, pouring salted peanuts in it, fucking drinking and eating it.
And watching Cannonball Run.
Watching Cannonball Run. Couldn't get any more southern than that shit.
Yeah, that's pretty southern, all right. Were you eating a moon pie, too?
Yeah, fucking banana moon pies. Banana moon pies.
Banana moon pies. All right, so if you haven't seen the original Hills Have Eyes, like I said, the remake is good, too. But, you know, if you love that fucking grotty 70s grindhouse type of aesthetic, you really can't beat the original. So definitely go check it out if you haven't seen it. The Blu-ray from Arrow Video is very rad, and it has like a whole bunch of extra stuff on it.
Yeah, it's worth getting a Blu-ray.
It's definitely worth getting. Yeah. So yeah, I really recommend it.